From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We have made it to Friday, and like last week, our week in review today is going to focus on politics. There's a lot of news that's been happening. Just as quickly as the Illinois General Assembly's veto session started last week, it wrapped up this week. And here to talk with us about that and what happened is Mike Miletich, Illinois Capitol reporter for WAND-TV, the NBC station that serves Decatur, Springfield, and Champaign-Urbana. Mike, welcome back to The 21st Show.
Thank you. Always glad to be on, Brian.
So as legislators were coming back for this fall veto session, there were questions about what the General Assembly might do to sort of Trump-proof Illinois, you might say, given the things the administration has pledged to do that may be in opposition to what Illinois' leadership wants to see happen. So how much of what you've seen in these past couple of weeks has been, you know, news business or tying up loose ends from the old session? Talk about what they've done in that regard.
Honestly, a lot of the discussions about bills to potentially address the Trump administration has been behind closed doors, just preparing for what lawmakers could do in early January. This veto session truly focused on bills that were just left over from the spring, trying to ensure that anything that was a top priority could be addressed. There were only roughly 8 bills passed over these 6 days. And I think one of the biggest bills that was a high priority for people in both chambers was passing the Dignity and Pay Act, which is ensuring that the subminimum wage for workers with developmental and intellectual disabilities is phased out over time, because a lot of people feel that everyone should be able to make a livable wage, especially one that's better than 50 cents an hour or $100 per month. And Brian, I'm sure that you know this has been years in the making, well before the 2024 election season. This dates back several General Assemblies.
Yeah, it did have, I think, bipartisan support. I'm looking at the Senate vote, 43 in favor, 11 against. What were some of the opposing views here?
Honestly, the opposing views come from people who agree something needs to be done to improve pay. But they were hoping for more of an easier transition instead of going right to $15 an hour come 2029. Senator Chapin Rose is from my viewing area, and he's worried many people in his district could lose their jobs once this law takes effect. You know, he is right by the Indiana border, and you think Indiana's minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. Well, from Paris, Illinois to Terre Haute, it's only about 20 minutes, and he's afraid that a lot of these businesses could close up shop here, maybe look to move across the border to Indiana, and leave a lot of these workers who are so excited to be there without work and left at home or in their sillas.
Yeah, and in case maybe if somebody didn't catch this detail, this is specifically we're talking about people who have like developmental disabilities often or some sort of disability. I heard one lawmaker during the debate saying that, you know, I think she has a relative who has a job like this. And for that person, it's really more about socialization, you know, having some dignity, having something to do rather than making the money. And I think what she was saying is she was concerned that, you know, the business may just not be able to go on if it has to pay out that much more money for, you know, products that are not necessarily based on economic demand or supply. And, you know, they don't necessarily match the laws of supply and demand, if I have that right.
That is right. And I think a lot of people are thinking about the next steps. Once this is signed, you know, they have until 2029. There would be a task force that has members from the industry that are people providing these jobs that could work with lawmakers to potentially make any changes that are necessary before they reach that timeline. I think another important aspect of this is that there is money that is set aside from the state. $2 million is a grant fund to help these community agencies transition away from the subminimum wage. And they're also talking about having the community group home residents receiving more of a personal allowance, $100 a month, so people can get by and not have to go through a situation where if they lose their job, they have nothing else. Another important component of it is a personal needs allowance will increase annually at the same rate as Social Security cost of living adjustments that many of us see year by year.
Okay, well, one of the other pieces of legislation I know you are following this week passed the State Senate unanimously. It's meant to expand treatment for people dealing with chronic pain. What's going on there?
This is a very interesting bill, and it addresses a situation that started in 2016. Most states implemented policies to severely restrict doctors from prescribing opioids because of opioid addiction and the opioid crisis across the country. But they didn't think about people that are chronic pain patients that actually need these treatments. So this bill will allow physicians to make the prescriptions for controlled substances, opioids, without those limitations based on dosage. And honestly, it's to address the major problem that doctors were reluctant to prescribe these medications for fear of being either criminalized or losing their license. So many of these patients, unfortunately, were self-medicating or putting themselves into physical harm because they didn't know the best step forward.
It's interesting though, because I mean, there were sound policy reasons when these restrictions were put in place, and you know, a lot of that has to do with the abuse that these drugs can result in, or the addiction, maybe I should say, the addiction disorder that people have when they can't sort of can't go on without these. How are they balancing those concerns?
Well, one of the key areas is reestablishing the relationship with the physician to the patient. And a key component of this bill is to protect patient confidentiality by saying that there is no treatment information available without a legal order verified by the state or an administrative subpoena also by the state. And that's to ensure that everything that is discussed is between the patient and the doctor. A lot of the times since 2016, people have been trying to figure this out by themselves. And now medical professionals can provide that life-saving service to patients who truly need it. And I'm sure that there's going to be more paperwork, more documentation to let people know how they can not go through overdose or addiction.
All right, Mike Miletich from WAND TV. Just a couple minutes left. I want to ask you about something else. You heard from Governor J.B. Pritzker this week. He was talking about electric vehicles. There are a lot of questions about what's going to be happening with that industry under the incoming Trump administration, but Pritzker says he is charging ahead, to use one of his phrases, to get more electric vehicles on the road in Illinois at least. And he was talking about charging stations. What is the plan there?
So he was at an event in Joliet in the Chicagoland suburbs, putting a multiple charging stations at a sports club over there. And the state is trying to ensure that there are fast charging stations every 50 miles across the state. One of the main complaints that people have right now with electric vehicles is there aren't enough chargers in major parts of the state. You could be around the Chicago area and see a ton of chargers. But if you come to central or southern Illinois, it's very limited. So the idea is that they could have roughly 2,000 fast charging ports installed over the next 18 months due to funding from the Climate and Equitable Jobs Act and a clean air settlement with Volkswagen. And that's where this money is coming to make it possible. Remember, the governor's goal is to have a million electrical vehicles on the road by 2030. Is that going to be challenged a bit with the Trump administration? A lot of people think it will. He's going to try and take away the federal tax credit that people receive if they buy an EV. But Pritzker noted the EV industry is relatively new, but it's grown significantly over recent years. And he's hoping having this charging station expansion can help more people get excited to buy these vehicles.
Mike Miletich is the state capitol reporter for WAND TV. Mike, thanks for sharing your reporting. Have a good weekend.
Absolutely. You have a good one too, Brian.
If you're just joining us, this is the 21st show. We are talking politics as part of our Friday roundtables, and we are going to turn now to Washington, where preparations for the incoming Trump administration continued with a number of bumps in the road.
Republicans on the House Ethics Committee have voted against releasing a report on the panel's long-running investigation into Matt Gaetz, President-elect Donald Trump's nominee for Attorney General.
CBS News has learned of Venmo records related to claims that Attorney General pick, that's Matt Gaetz, paid for sex. We've also now seen a police report from a sexual assault allegation against Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth.
President-elect Donald Trump's pick of Linda McMahon as the next Secretary of Education is already raising alarm among critics who feel the role should go to someone with more experience in education.
Well, okay, all that proved to be too much for at least one of the potential nominees, and that was Matt Gaetz. As you probably know by now, he withdrew his bid to be the Attorney General. Trump has made some other choices for administration positions. A lot has also happened in the Congress, and with me to talk about it all is Linda Kenyon, Illinois Public Media's Washington correspondent. Linda, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you, Brian. It has been a very, very busy week indeed, or I should say busy 2 weeks.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think we talked a week ago and it's been the longest month of your life, probably feels like. All right. So we just heard, not a laughing matter, but Matt Gaetz withdrew his bid to be Attorney General. We talked last week about the controversy around that selection. What ultimately was the breaking point?
I think the breaking point was that he was starting to get a tremendous pushback because of not one but two investigations against him. One, the Justice Department had investigated him on allegations of sex trafficking and illicit drug use. It did not return any charges. But the House Ethics Committee had its own investigation and had completed a report. And the problem with that investigation is that as soon as Matt Gaetz was named as Donald Trump's pick for Attorney General, he resigned as a member of the House, leaving the House Ethics Committee no jurisdiction over him. So everybody wants to know what's in that report. He, of course, has said repeatedly that all of the allegations against him are false and he is an innocent man, but nonetheless, some of the details of that report did leak, which should come as no surprise in Washington because Washington leaks like a sieve. However, it just all proved to be a little bit too much, and he resigned. Now, the big surprise with that is how fast it happened and how fast Donald Trump was willing to accept a resignation without putting up a fight. However, within hours, he named somebody else to take over as his pick for Attorney General. And she has some controversy as well, but is very likely to win confirmation without the kind of blowback that the previous nominee, Matt Gaetz, was experiencing.
Yes, one of the nominees who, at least so far, has not been accused of any sort of sexual assault. And, you know, one of those, one of the multiple people who has been accused of that is still in the running, and that is Pete Hegseth, who's the Fox News weekend host and Trump's selection for Secretary of Defense. There's a woman who alleged that Hegseth raped her. Also, Trump wants Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to lead the Department of Health and Human Services. A former babysitter to his kids accused RFK Jr. of sexual assault. And then we can also talk a little bit about Linda McMahon, Trump's pick for the Department of Education. She's accused of covering up sexual abuse of boys when she ran World Wrestling Entertainment. Let's set her aside for now. But, you know, Linda, looking at these from a sort of a 10,000-foot level, 30,000-foot level, you know, we had this Me Too movement. It wasn't all that long ago. Maybe it almost seems like there's a backlash reaction to it, sort of pressing ahead with so many of these nominees despite these allegations. What effect are these accusations having on these presumptive nominees?
Well, keep in mind the president-elect himself has had these allegations as well, and he was convicted in a civil court in a case involving sexual assault, and owes a rather sizable judgment to the person who had accused him and to which he had been convicted civilly. Now, what does this mean? Well, it's possible, you know, there's a lot of head scratching going on in Washington that the Matt Gaetz nomination, now former pick for Attorney General, was kind of the sacrificial lamb, that he was the one who had the most blatant allegations against him. And even Republican senators who would be required to vote on his confirmation were having second thoughts. So he was pulled, or as he said, he resigned so as not to create a distraction for the Trump administration. And then that's it. That was the sacrifice. And now they'd be more willing to confirm the other nominees, regardless of the allegations or outright charges that could be against them or just allegations at this point. So yeah. That's one school of thought. The other
Let's pause before we get into the other school of thought, because we need to take a break. So we will come back to that. It is interesting. I'll just say briefly on this idea of the sort of sacrificial lamb, right? One of these terms you hear in Washington nomination fights. That makes sense to me when you're actually voting, maybe in January, but there's two more months of potential details of these allegations to come out. It seems very early to be having these fights in this process. We're going to talk more about that with Linda Kenyon, Illinois Public Media's Washington correspondent, in our political roundtable this week. This is the 21st show. Stay with us. It's the 21st show. This is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are continuing with Linda Kenyon, Illinois Public Media's Washington correspondent. And Linda, before the break, we were talking about some of President-elect Trump's nominees for his cabinet. Of course, Matt Gaetz withdrew his bid to be attorney general this week amid charges that he had paid a 17-year-old. Not charges, I should say allegations, that he had paid a 17-year-old for sex on multiple occasions, as well as other behavior that maybe not strictly speaking illegal, is maybe not something that we've seen with previous nominees to be attorney general. We're also, and before the break we were talking about how, well, maybe now that he has sort of withdrawn his bid, senators may be willing to overlook the fact or the accusation that RFK Jr. has been alleged to have sexually assaulted one of his kids' babysitters, and Pete Hegseth has been accused of sexually assaulting a woman. What was the other point you were going to make on this nomination fight, and where the Republican, soon to be Republican held Senate may go here?
Well, the school of thought is that Donald Trump is first and foremost very keen on Trump loyalists, and every single member of his cabinet picks have been Trump loyalists. And that seems to be the deciding factor for him in all cases. Doesn't matter. For example, in the case of the defense secretary pick, Pete Hegseth, he is a Fox News anchor. That is the president's elect's favorite network. A number of his picks have come from Fox News. And he has no experience whatsoever running a department, managerial experience. And the Defense Department is a behemoth of a department. He also, while he did serve in the military, he is not high up in the military ranks and never was. And therefore, what he does have going for him is that he does have a very handsome appearance, which visualization is very important to the president, and loyalism. And this is, quite frankly, loyalism probably the top issue for him. He does demand loyalty.
And, okay, one of the other, again, not formally nominees yet, but designees, I guess, for a Trump cabinet is Linda McMahon, his pick to lead the Department of Education, which he and some of his allies have said they want to dismantle. So McMahon is a former head of the U.S. Small Business Administration. She has cabinet experience from the first Trump administration. She's also a co-founder of World Wrestling Entertainment. There have been accusations that she helped cover up sexual abuse of boys when she ran World Wrestling Entertainment, WWE. Why Linda McMahon for the Department of Education?
Yeah, it's very interesting because that's a department he wants to eliminate. So if I were named as a designee to head a department that was going to be eliminated, I would think twice, wouldn't you? So, but nonetheless, I think that the president is going to find that abolishing a department is not an easy thing to do. And it does require, by the way, an act of Congress because it was created by Congress. So this could be something that will be a long, long-term project. So Linda McMahon is a Trump loyalist, and she does have experience in the Trump cabinet. And although the allegations against her as well, in several cases, in all of these cases we've mentioned so far today, have to do with various sexual improprieties, either overlooking them or actually being involved in them, in her case, overlooking them allegedly, none of that seems to matter. And loyalism always seems to be the cream that rises to the top.
All right. We've been talking about Trump's potential cabinet. Let's turn now to the Congress, which Democrats have about a month and a half left until they lose their majority in the Senate. One part of what they've been trying to do is confirm judicial nominees. Republicans have been doing what they can to slow down the process this week. How has that been playing out?
Well, there's been some blowback on that. In the Senate, the way it is designed, there is a lot of rights. There was said the minority has rights, and the minority can block things. And in this case, presently, it's the Republicans who are in the minority, and they've been using various procedural maneuvers, which they are certainly able to do, and their party does certainly encourage them to do it. They have been slow walking these nominations, basically running out the clock. So they came to an agreement this week after many late night sessions of confirming judicial nominees before the Republicans become the majority party in the Senate. And the agreement pleased some and upset others. It was a deal to work on seven of the current president's nine stalled judicial nominees. Because they did spark an intense fight on the Senate floor this week through these various procedural movements and actions by the Republican minority. And then after confirming those, there'll be more confirmations after the Thanksgiving recess. But in exchange, the Republicans agreed that they would not block these nominees, but Democrats will have to agree to hold votes on four. They've agreed not to hold votes, I should say, on four other Biden appellate court nominees. These are higher up in the ranks. So Democrats are upset about that because they feel that they should not have made that deal, that they should have pressed ahead with these appellate court nominees as well. And Republicans are upset with the deal because they feel that seven of these nine stalled judicial nominees should not get consideration. And so the very essence of compromise is when neither side is happy, then you've compromised.
That is certainly one way of looking at it. You know, how does this compare with past presidential transitions, in a lame duck Congress where you have a party switch coming up? I'm reminded of, and I'm sure some of our listeners are thinking of, how Republicans managed to block a Supreme Court nominee from even getting consideration in one case like this, and then they rushed through another Supreme Court nominee a few years later when in a similar situation when they had power. I'm sure there are people saying, look, why aren't Democrats just doing everything they possibly can to stack the judiciary with as many more judges as they can before the clock runs out?
Yeah, well, it is standard procedure to try and rush to get everything done as much as possible. By the way, you will recall that the Supreme Court nominee, who wasn't even afforded a hearing under the Republican-controlled Congress during the Obama administration, was Merrick Garland, who is presently the Attorney General now. So, sometimes what goes around comes around, but it is kind of standard practice to kind of jam everything in to sort of cram for the final exam, if you will. Before the next administration takes office and there's a switch of control in the House or the Senate.
All right. Last thing I want to ask you about: Republicans focused a lot in the last election on attacking Democrats on transgender issues, and that's not really seem to be going anywhere post-election. Congresswoman Mary Miller, who is a Republican from Central Illinois and a member of the Freedom Caucus, spoke this week at a panel where she reiterated her support for, as an example, banning gender-affirming care for trans youth. How have you seen Republicans focusing on these issues in the Congress, whether that's, you know, legislation or, I guess, even rules dealing with how their fellow members are going to be able to work in the building?
Well, the first thing that they passed was a rules change by Nancy Mace, the Republican from South Carolina. She sponsored the bill, and it bars anyone from using single-sex restrooms in the U.S. Capitol that does not align with their biological sex at birth. This is a direct targeting of Sarah McBride. She is a Democrat from the state of Delaware. She is a trans woman, and she is a newly elected member of the House. Now, there's been an awful lot of dust up over this. You do probably recall that transgender rights was very central to the Trump campaign. And so what's happened is McBride herself posted a statement on X calling this all a distraction. She said, I'm going to quote, "I'm not here to fight about bathrooms. Like all members, I will follow the rules as outlined by Speaker Johnson, even if I disagree with them." And she called it an effort to distract from the real issues facing this country. But she says that this distraction has not distracted me. So, you know, there's been a lot of political capital spent on this right out of the gate. And a lot of people are scratching their heads about that one.
Linda Kenyon is the Washington correspondent for Illinois Public Media. Thank you so much for being with us. Have a good weekend.
Thank you. You too.
This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and that is King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band, obviously from much earlier in the history of that genre, and a group that worked out of Chicago. That recording is more than a century old. It reflects a moment in jazz history. The song you just heard, Chimes Blues, includes the first recorded solo of a man who would become a music legend, Louis Armstrong. A lot of the recordings from this era have been lost or forgotten, but there's a record label based out of Champaign that is working to change that. Archaeophone Records got its start more than a quarter century ago. Its aim is to preserve and restore historic recordings dating from the 1920s on the near end and as far back as around 1890. The label's gotten a couple dozen Grammy nominations over the year, with one win in 2006 for Best Historical Album. And in the last few weeks, Archaeophone got three more Grammy nominations for its work, including for the box set with the restored recording you just heard. Here to talk about all of that are the label's co-founders, husband and wife Richard Martin and Megan Hennessy. Rich, Megan, congratulations on the latest nominations. Welcome to The 21st Show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thanks, Brian.
So the track is on a box set called Centennial. Talk about the history behind that.
Behind the set?
Yeah, sure. Or the song. Take it where you will.
The recordings of the King Oliver Band that were made in 1923 have long been regarded as some of the most seminal jazz recordings in the genre's history. It's really the time where, you know, jazz starts to take shape on record. It's not jazz like we think of it now with all these improvised solos. It's really more about polyphony and section playing. They've been put out before. People have heard them before, but never all in one place quite like we've done it, and never with the quality of sound like we've got it. They're very sought-after records. From 1923, like I said, and the price that they're realized in auctions is typically very high, much beyond our means. So we are lucky to have partnered with a number of top drawer collectors from all over America and Europe to get the best copies and restore them for this set.
Why is music from this era so forgotten or maybe so hard to come by?
I think the answer on that depends on what the recordings are and what the time period is. In the case of these records, you know, not necessarily a lot of them were made at the time. And when you go back to the earlier period we worked with, early into the 1890s, mass production wasn't a thing for records. And so people would go into a studio and record, and maybe you get six copies. And then they would do that again and again and again. And before mass production, there just aren't as many records out there, and they're hard to find. They didn't necessarily survive. They were very fragile, too, particularly the stuff from the 90s.
And the other reason is the sound. Prior to the days of microphones showing up in the studios in 1925, the performers had to gather around a horn and shout if they're singing, or play their instruments right into the bell of the horn. And the recordings were made by mechanical means only. It's the force of the sound waves through the funnel-like horn, all centered on a sensitive diaphragm that then vibrated a needle and cut sound waves into wax. And that's what you're hearing.
Kind of like the opposite of the phonograph, just, you know, where the people know the RCA logo, right, with the dog leaning its ear into the horn. You're sort of playing the sound in reverse in that situation,
I guess,
to do the recording itself.
Yeah. Right. It's in fact, you know, if you had a cylinder phonograph, you could do both. You could cut a record and then change out the cutter for a reproducer and play it back at home. It's a wonderful invention. People, you know, flock to it. But today, you know, it's regarded, I think, by some as being primitive, or they think the sound is a little funny, and you know, doesn't have crystal clear CD style audio. And so, I think that is a stumbling block for some people.
Yeah, well, let's get another example of it. We're going to take a break, and we will listen to another track that Archaeophone has restored. This is from an earlier project called Waxing the Gospel. This is the Hallelujah Chorus, as recorded by Baldwin's Cadet Band of Boston all the way back in the mid-1890s. We want to hear from you. What do you appreciate about this, both the recording, this work? We're going to take a listen. You can join us at 800-222-9455, and we will have more with Richard Martin and Megan Hennessy, co-founders and co-owners of Archaeophone Records in Champaign, Illinois. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us.
Bye.
This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and that is The Dancing Deacon by Dabney's Band, a recording from 1919. It's recordings like that that are the bread and butter of Archaeophone Records, a label based in Champaign that focuses on preserving and restoring historic recordings. We're talking about this with the co-founders and co-owners, husband and wife duo Richard Martin and Megan Hennessy. Archaeophone's work has just gotten 3 Grammy nominations in the past few weeks. We're going to talk about that, too. You can join us today at 800-222-9455. All right, what made you both want to get into preserving this music?
So we both grew up listening to pop music and following the Billboard charts, and at some point started to wonder what happened before rock and roll, and read and realized there was this enormous universe of material that had been kind of forgotten and overlooked. There were a few big names that people would remember, but a lot of the artists, a lot of the repertoire, a lot of the sound was just written out of history, not included. And we thought, there's a big story here to be told, and we wanted to tell it with research and illustrations and try to bring it to life.
I want to talk a little about your process, and maybe we can do that by way of example. We're going to listen to another track from that set, Centennial, that we talked about at the beginning. This is called The Fatal Stone from the opera Aida, as recorded by trombonist Arthur Pryor and cornet player Emil Kenneke. Rich and Megan, talk about how that came to you and how it is now and how you got it from point A to point B.
Ah, okay. Well, that's a 1909 disc record, Victor record from 1909. And, you know, the boring behind-the-scenes work is you need a clean copy of the record. You need to physically clean it, right, get all the dirt out of it. You need to have a good system, a good turntable. You need to center the record. You need to choose the right stylus to fit the groove so that you can minimize noise that way. Get a stereo transfer, even though it's a mono recording, because in the restoration sphere, one side of the groove is more damaged than the other. You can have options. And you get a good digital high-res transfer of it. And from there, ingested into the digital audio workstation, the DAW, as some people call it. And from there, I, you know, do things like declicking, you know, a variety of means of noise reduction, and then some sort of surgical type sculpting, I guess you'd say, of where I go through the signal microsecond by microsecond to clean up little areas that are, infelicitous. And then you do the EQing and mastering, which once you have all the other tracks, the mastering is when you sort of put it all together and make it fit together. That's,
you know, and
how it goes.
And I can sort of picture what you're describing, because working in sound ourselves and radio, I have some experience with digital audio workstations, although I think probably not to the level of particularity that you have to bring to these projects. But maybe for people who aren't familiar with that, you know, when you make a digital recording of a sound file, it's really a bunch of ones and zeros. It's sort of a chart. You can picture a piece of graph paper where you have the low sounds on the bottom, the high sounds on the top, and it's time as you go from left to right, and you can just really zoom in. Or when you say you're sculpting it, you're making little minute changes, and you know, say the 8,000 kilohertz frequency at, you know, 14.332 on this recording or something like that.
Yeah, the big advance over the last 20 years or so, maybe not quite that long, is the prevalence now of spectrographic based software programs. So what you're referring to is dead accurate. I mean, in terms of what you know we've had to work with for decades, but now you can, you know, the program is called Isotope RX. You know, like pharmacy RX, fixing the signal. And with the heat map of spectrography, what you get is time on the x-axis, but frequency on the vertical, and amplitude is signified by the severity of the intensity, I should say, of the light on the pattern. And with that, now you can just go to, like you say, 8,000 hertz and fix that little blip that's there. Whereas before, with regular audio editors, any change you make to the signal at any point in time affects zero all the way up to 22,000 hertz.
Yeah.
With the spectrographic, you can go in and just target a tiny part.
All right. I love this. I'm nerding out here. I'm worried we may lose some of our listeners. So
it's always a risk.
Yeah. All right. So that's the sort of the sound file, the actual acoustic aspect of what you do. The other thing is the history behind this music. How do you integrate that context into your work?
Well, every reissue we've done has substantial album notes. I think the smallest booklet we've ever included is 12 pages, and that was... I think that's only one of those. And so in the case of the Centennial Box Set, for example, which is nominated for historical album and album notes, we've got an 80-page hardback book. And so we...
But it's a 12-by-12
12-by-12, yeah, 80-page 12-by-12 book. And so we do research. Sometimes we hire writers who are experts on the artists or the material we're covering. But our goal is to... We talk about the records. We talk about the history. We try really, really hard to make them real and to offer insight so that there's something other than kind of a quaint old record.
Yeah, this is not a nostalgia business. We're not interested in, you know, the hits that your grandparents listened to, except that, you know, we want to talk about the times that your grandparents lived in, you know, and what that meant for the music, the recordings, the performers, etc.
You know, I think when people hear this music today, unless they are a collector or a scholar or somebody very history minded, you know, they maybe picture a Buster Keaton short or something like that. Some of the you know, the jazzy or sort of ragtime music, it's black and white. It has that sort of the same feeling we maybe feel. You know, the video that seems a little speeded up because of the way the cameras worked and the way we look at it now. I'm trying to think of how to ask this to you. When you hear this music, when you think about it, are you hearing it in that sort of old-timey black and white way, or does it somehow become more, you know, in color to you?
It's very alive to us. I mean, we, like I said, the sound takes some getting used to for a newbie, but once you get it, there's no other kind of sound like this. In fact, the piece you just played by Pryor and Kenneke of the aria from Aida, that's on Centennial because along with our writer Ricky Riccardi, who's the expert on Louis Armstrong, he's the research director at the Louis Armstrong House in Corona, Queens, New York. We put together a CD of records that Louis Armstrong himself actually owned, or that he was very fond of, or that he knew about, because what he was doing in the late 19-teens, and then really all the way till he died, was he was constantly collecting records and studying the tone, and what he called it tonation, we might say tonality, but he loved that sound, and he was trying to imitate it. So when you hear these sui generis, you know, records of the earliest jazz recordings, bear in mind, the guy making the record wanted to sound like your phonograph. He wanted to channel that sound and perfect it.
And just to add on to what Rich said, the longer you listen, the more you recognize the craft of engineering in the oldest days. You talked about the recording horn process in the last section. You know, everything was recorded live. It was one take. They couldn't go in and redo it. And the artistry and the staging needed to make sure everybody was heard and everything sounded optimal was, it was an art. For example, going to the first, you know, Oliver recordings, one of the challenges they had was that Louis Armstrong played loudly enough that he drowned everybody else out. So they literally made him stand at the back of the room so that they could hear the other artists. That's an art of engineering.
Yeah, that's great. All right, so we've mentioned a couple of times these Grammy nominations. There have been dozens over the years. What is that like? Are you going to parties with Taylor Swift and Paul McCartney?
There's still hope.
No, not usually.
No, well, again, Brian, since you're a nerd, you might be interested in the sort of people that are good friends of ours or people that we meet. They tend to be the production people, the engineers. And some of them are big names, but, you know, most of your listeners, you know, probably have never heard of them. So we get to meet people like that. The event itself is fine. It's fun. It's, you know, we've done it a number of times now, so there's kind of a sameness, but you got to be there in case they call your name. So we'll be heading out in February, and hopefully this one will get us back to the winner's circle.
Well, yeah, I mean, so I mentioned for all these nominations, you've won once. You know, they say it's an honor to be nominated. How do you feel about that?
It's true, it is. I mean, it even if you don't win, it's an amazing feeling to, and a point of pride to have your work recognized as the best by your peers. I mean, it's funny, we're talking a lot about sound, but our label has 27 nominations total, and we actually have 17 for album notes. And this year we have two albums up against each other for notes, and we're proud to be producing that kind of serious work.
Yeah, no, it's great to be recognized that way. Megan Hennessy, Richard Martin, are co-founders and owners of Champagne's Archaeophone Records. Thank you so much for joining us, and again, congratulations and good luck.
Thanks for giving us the time. Yeah. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks so much for having us.
And we are going to leave you today with one more track off of the Grammy-nominated album After Midnight. This is Dabney's Band, and the song is called That's It. And on that note, that is it for us this week. The 21st Show is produced by Anna Casey, Christine Hatfield, and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Coulson Khan. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. And today, special thanks to Jerry Moorfield. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thank you for listening. We'll talk with you again next week.